Before we get going tonight, I just wanted to put this up front about the relationship between this podcast and Narsal. Larry and I both do volunteer work for Narsal, but this podcast is of our own creation. I asked Narsal to help promote it as a favor. That is the extent of the relationship between the two organizations. If you're mad at us for being political, by all means be mad at us, not Narsal. However, on that note, if you disagree with me or Larry, feel free to be specific, write comments, email, and hey, maybe we would have you on the show so you could duke out the issues. I hope you enjoy the show. Good evening, Larry. How are you tonight?
Doing really fantastic. How are you?
I think this is the first episode being recorded as of fall, I think.
Think?
I'm not positive. Wasn't fall last weekend, or did that happen a couple weeks back?
I think it might be the second one.
Oh, all right. Hey, a couple hours ago, they confirmed Kavanaugh 50-48.
Well, my predictions were wrong. I was predicted 55. So
he is, I think they're saying, like, the most unpopular Supreme Court justice in whatever modern history is or something like that.
Well, it would certainly be the slimmest margin that I've ever heard of. And 50-48 means that that somebody was absent and somebody else probably paired with the absence to keep it so the same ratio would be there.
Right. And yes, I don't remember the senator's name, but she voted present. Is that Murkowski?
I'm not sure how the vote went down. But if someone's going to be absent, sometimes they'll pair another person with them so that they don't it doesn't change the outcome.
Right. So a Democrat was out, and then so a Republican just they take the bye, right?
Yes.
Well, and do you have any updated thoughts on how this might change our situation and what we're fighting for?
It's too early to tell. We'll be getting into we'll be getting into some articles that deal with the Supreme Court later in judicial philosophy, but we've looked at appointments to the Supreme Court through the years, and people have gotten it all wrong. I mean, Eisenhower thought that Chief Justice Earl Warren was going to be to his liking. He turned out not to be. I think Eisenhower referred to him as the biggest mistake he made because he was too much of a liberal. And more recently, if we go through the decades, when Justice William O. Douglas retired in 75, we had an unelected president. And of course, that could have easily been used as the same doctrine McConnell used. They should have said in 75 that this appointment belongs to the next elected president, but they didn't do that. The unelected president, Gerald Ford, was allowed to appoint a justice. And there was a great concern about he was going to be shifting the philosophy of the court dramatically to the right because Ford was a conservative, and ended up he appointed a barely liberal. Yeah, I don't think he knew it at the time, but John Paul Stevens turned out to be somewhat of a liberal. Then more recent than that, we had George H.W. Bush appoint David Souter. And David Souter was thought to be a conservative, and he turned out to vote more often with the liberal bloc. I'm not suggesting that Kavanaugh or Gorsuch are going to magically become liberals because their history doesn't suggest that, but I will suggest that no one can really predict what they're going to do. And if they keep an open mind on cases, we just have to hope for the best because they're there for their life, and they're going to be there for 30, maybe even more years.
Yeah, I mean, RBG is 85, I think. And so these two guys, Gorsuch is my age. He's in his late 40s, and Kavanaugh's only in his early mid 50s. So they could totally be there for 40 years.
So when you say RBG, not a soul knows who you're talking about. He's talking about Bader Ginsburg, who's an associate justice of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, she's about 100 pounds and 1,000 years old.
And every time you see her in a type of public, she seems to be under a blanket. Have you noticed that? Seems like she's under a quilt.
She's 100 pounounds. She's got like -5% body fat. And anything that the slightest little breeze strikes her, and she's probably freezing to death.
Justice Ginsburg is up there, and the maybe the next replacement for the president. If she's going to try to outlive Trump, she may have to live 6 more years.
Jesus. Yeah, I can think of other things that I would rather. We're going to kind of cover this in a minute, but Gorsuch has voted, quote unquote, in our favor at least twice that I know of.
Well, when you say in our favor, you have to look at the issues of which way he's voting and what the issues are. Sometimes the issues are different than what you think they are, like the case we're going to talk about with Gundy a little bit later. The issues of Gundy are far different than what people think they are, and we're going to cover that.
Yeah, and then there's, I can't remember what the issue was the other way, but he sided with the liberals for a completely different reason. It just so happens, you know, they vote black and white, even though his reasons for voting were very different.
Yeah, well, that was on the case of Void for Vagueness, when the Trump administration was wanting to deport people with the language of a serious, whatever it was, violent, however they described that, and he said it wasn't sufficiently succinct to give people adequate notice of what would constitute a deportable offense. And he's right about that, but he sided with the liberals.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, we just don't know how any of this stuff is going to play out. And we can't control it anyway. I mean,
I thought you had tea leaves and magic eight balls and no?
These people are beyond our reach. The only thing is they can be impeached, but it's a very high bar, and I'm not sure that a Supreme Court justice has ever been impeached.
That also seems like, I mean, that's a constitutional crisis kind of event.
Right. And I don't think there has been an impeachment of a Supreme Court justice. So
that's because they're properly vetted and they go through a whole initiation process of getting them there. Huh.
Well,
I wonder if there's like pretty good transparency before they get there.
I would argue the vetting process has gotten more strict as time has progressed. If you look at what vetting John Paul Stevens went through in 75, it wouldn't be anything like what we just saw go this vetting and recent vettings. I would say that they've gotten more thorough. That's probably why they don't get it wrong as often on terms of what their judicial philosophy is.
That's my point, though, because all these documents from Kavanaugh's history were kept locked up, whatever.
Well, the possibly some of his executive, he worked in the executive branch, but his judicial work is not locked up. Their published opinions are out there to be absorbed and studied. But if they've not served on the court to have a track record, you wouldn't be able to look at their decisions. But I think that we're doing a lot more thorough job of vetting than what they were in yesteryear. I think that the likelihood of knowing what you're getting, at least philosophically, is far greater than it was in Eisenhower or Ford's days, and possibly even the first George Bush.
Hmm. Well, you ready to roll on?
Sure.
Well, I definitely want to thank our patrons, and you're definitely helping support the show, and we really appreciate it. So if you want to help support the show, you can visit us over at Patreon, and that's Patreon. I got a comment from a friend that said, no idea how to spell Patreon. So there it is, Patreon, Patreon.com, and then /registrymatters. Even $1 a month just goes to show how much you support or you appreciate our efforts here on the podcast. First up, we have a comment. Go ahead, Larry.
If you started typing something that resembled Patreon in your search engine, wouldn't it give you a lead to it? That's usually the way it works for me.
I would agree with that. I got to think if you get reasonably close to Patreon, that Google would help you out. But you know, maybe you don't use Google. Maybe you use DuckDuckGo
or some of these other less efficient search vehicles.
That's right. Mike, a patron, Mike, wrote about episode 44 and the article we had about the vigilante justice. And he says, last thing I need is some whack job showing up my house like a psycho in Tennessee. That is just effing stupid. Why our names, employees, and our auto information are out there for these crazies to see. I can't agree with him any more than what he put together there.
I agree with him also that we've had so much violence and so much damage done because of the public registry. And it's not going to change until we do away with the public aspect. If we're going to have this silly beast, we need to do away with the public aspect of it.
And the guy, you know, the story we cover, the guy was like, heck yeah, I did it. We need to shoot them people.
So well, hopefully he gets to spend some time in the incarcerated himself.
Let's project on that particular individual for a moment. Do you think that we could actually, quote unquote, rehabilitate his thinking?
Well, it would be disingenuous if we were to give up. I mean, he clearly has got distorted thinking, but that's kind of what we claim that, I mean, we're about fixing. Thinking errors is what got most people in the predicament on the sex offender registry. There was a lapse in judgment. to download the porn or to touch the underage minor. That those were thinking errors, and although I find his thinking errors very appalling, I would hope that we could show some mercy and try to rehabilitate him. I would hate to write him off, but yes, it does look bleak when you have such serious thinking errors to think you can go out and do your own justice. Like, it's kind of contrary to what our system's founded upon.
The other thing, though, in that is when he gets, you know, if he does serve any time, he's going to be like a hero. Someone's going to just come over and fill up his locker box with soups and stuff just for what he has done.
Well, that's thinking errors on the people and the inside. And we could spend a whole podcast about how the thinking is distorted in prisons, the hierarchy and the things that they look up to and the way the prisoners administer mob justice on people and how they don't believe in due process, except for when they don't feel like they got their due process, but they certainly jettison all due process in prison environment.
Right, 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 right. And we also received a voicemail message, so let's give this a listen.
Good afternoon. I just finished listening to REM 44, Why Your Delusionality Never Works Out the Way You Plan. And of particular interest to me, since I am a registered citizen who lives in the state of Tennessee, was the segment you did on the gentleman who used the man who used the registry to locate two sex offenders that live near him and vandalize their property and actually shoot at them. And I was wondering, just a question for discussion, at what point is this type of incident going to reach the critical stage to where the courts will no longer be able to overlook the fact that the registry does constitute cruel and unusual punishment, because it gives violent vigilantes a roadmap right to your house? If they don't know where you live, they take your street address, plug it into Google Maps, and they can get a turn-by-turn roadmap to where you live and do harm to you or your family or both. And also, a case that's coming up, I think it's going to have some far-reaching effects if we win, is Gundy versus the United States, about the non-delegation of legislative powers from the Congress to anyone else. And this, of course, dealing with Congress giving the United States Attorney General a blank check to retroactively apply the federal SORNA law retroactively in any way he sees fit. So basically, he gets to write the laws and then choose who he's going to prosecute under those laws that he has come up with. And I would like for you, if you could, to contact me at 609-2. And also, in Tennessee, all registered citizens have an 11-day, that's right, an 11-day curfew from October the 21st to November the 1st. And for those 11 days, we have to be indoors from 6 p.m. till 6 a.m. the next morning. People can go to treatment who are required to. People who work nights can go to work. But people like myself who go to church can't be allowed out of their house to go to church for their evening services. And I would like for us to cover this Halloween problem as well. Have a great day and keep up the great work. I enjoy listening. Bye-bye.
Wait a minute. I didn't hear that part at the end. Doesn't that bring up a First Amendment right there?
Well, it does, yes.
I mean, and you could, like, I guess you could go and get yourself arrested, and you're like, I'm exercising my First Amendment right to assembly and worship and all that.
You could, but let's try to dissect his. He's basically got three questions in there.
Yeah, he has three. I got that.
Got the Halloween at the end. He's got Gundy.
Yes.
And then he's got, at what point can the courts deny that the registry constitutes cruel and unusual punishment? And it might be good to go through them one by one. We're going to do Gundy little bit on Gundy later, but
so we'll shelve that one till later.
In terms of the 11-day restriction, the The presumption is that anything that's enacted into statute and signed by the executive of the state or the federal, in the case of the president, those legislative acts are presumed to be constitutional. It's presumed. The courts, through 200 plus years of jurisprudence, have decided that since they are the legislative branch, that and they are directly answerable to the people to create public policy, that there's great deference afforded to the elected officials. The judicial branch affords those acts great deference. If a person believes that they're unconstitutional, they have to raise that challenge, which means that the registered offender population, one or more of them in Tennessee, are going to have to raise that as a challenge. They're going to have to set it forth in a complaint, either in state or federal court. I tend to prefer federal courts over most state courts, particular states that have elected judges, because they're more at the whims of the people. But the Article III U.S. Constitution judges have a little more independence because they don't have that whimsical public to worry about their vote. And they need to bring these claims and assert them in a court of law and show that the violations are happening and see how the chips fall. To my knowledge, I don't believe the 11-day restriction has been challenged in Tennessee. If it has been, it hasn't made its way to NARSL, which I'm the legal coordinator for, and I've not been made aware of a direct challenge on that. So that would be something that I would encourage Tennesseans to do.
I've never heard of that. Have you heard of that big of a blanket at Halloween?
Other than in Tennessee, I've heard of this before this comment came in. We've had an attorney colleague in Tennessee tell us about it, and he's a small solo practitioner, is not prepared to undertake a constitutional challenge pro bono, but we're aware of it, and that's part of the problem. The offender population has limited resources in some cases. Some that have more than adequate resources don't feel that, for whatever their reasons are, I can't speak to, that they don't want to contribute, and we end up not having the wherewithal to undertake these challenges. But I think that would be a good one, because that's a minor inconvenience for Halloween would be different if you've got a 4 or 5 hour curfew from 6 o'clock or sundown to 12 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night. But you're talking about an extended deprivation of liberty, and you've got a liberty interest there. And I would think this type of challenge could get some traction. But try not to run to every lawyer and say, can you do this pro bono? Try to run to the lawyer and say, we've got a cause of action, and we believe in it so much that we're willing to pony up and help fund this challenge, because we know the state's going to fight back with all barrels blazing to defend this law. And try that approach and see if it works better than just going in and feeling entitled to pro bono representation, because that's what often the offender population feels, that they have a right to have these wrongs remedied at someone else's expense. So we live in a capitalist system where those attorneys have to pay their bills and pay their staff and pay their office rent and buy Nikes for their kids. And they have responsibilities in life just like everyone else.
They have to buy Nikes so that they can go burn them.
I'm not sure there's any burning of Nikes going on.
Not now. There were a couple weeks ago.
Well, I heard Nike stock has actually soared.
Yes, but there were people running around taking their Nikes and whatever the lighter fluid is, put that all over them and torch them. But I had never heard of the 11 days. Yes, it's an inconvenience on Halloween itself to be in at 5 o'clock or whatever, and you can't go out until 7 the next morning. But for 11 days, I'm just kind of shocked by it.
It sounds like it's ripe for a challenge, and we would be. At the NARSL level, we'd be receptive to trying to help. And when I say help, it's very limited help because we have very limited resources, but we would be receptive to that challenge and be supportive of it. But it's going to require some offender support as well.
But what does October 29th have to do with Halloween or 30th? Or I mean, what? I can't even.
Well,
people
do Halloween. They don't just exclusively trick or treat on Halloween. I'm learning that myself, that there's a lot of parties and group activities that people engage in, and they facilitate them on leading up to Halloween.
Why can't you go to an adult-only Halloween party on October 25th?
Well, I would ask the same question. But the reason why you can't is because the law says you can't.
And this is a Tennessee law. This isn't just your state sheriff's office or your local sheriff's office.
This is I think they call it holiday festival, but yeah, this is applied to everyone on the registry. This is not a
super condition. Oh my, well, okay. But even, all right. Jeepers, man. I hadn't heard of that one. That one's, that's crazy. That's completely crazy.
Well, it's not crazy because it's presumed constitutional until someone challenges it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to use this term I'm going to start referring to it. Courts are not roving tribunals.
Right.
Judges don't wake up one morning and say, I'm feeling a little bit bored today. What kind of mischief can I make in terms of laws? There has to be a controversy between parties, and it has to be brought to the courts. And the courts, the judge may very well, there may be judges who know about the Halloween stuff, and they may find it repugnant, but they're powerless to intervene until a case in controversy comes before the court. They don't get up going out looking for something to do.
Which is goes to my suggestion. This is a pretty aggressive means to get you into the court system. Go to church, let them arrest you. You have controversy.
Well, and the courts have held that you don't have to subject yourself to arrest. That's certainly one mechanism to force the issue. And if you force it that way, you're in a criminal court setting. You can also bring civil actions challenging. There's various civil remedies available to you that you can do without having to subject yourself to arrest, as long as you have a reasonable fear of prosecution. If you're within a zone, a person in Tennessee who's not on the sex offender registry and has no obligation to register, they wouldn't have what's called standing to bring a challenge against the Halloween restrictions because there's no controversy between them. They can go out and do what they want to. Now you start branching out from that. Possibly a person who's not on the registry that's related to, you know, that same household might could pigeonhole in and say that they have standing because it's disrupting the family. But you've got to have legal standing to bring a challenge, and an arrest is one way. I don't ever advise that. I would consider doing it myself, but I'd never advise anybody to do all the crazy stuff I would do myself. but you have to be prepared to make the bond. You've got to be prepared to have legal representation. You've got to be prepared for what they can throw at you. And a lot of people are not prepared as well as I would be prepared, but I don't much care for jail either. I don't think I would be looking for a fight, but there's certain things I wouldn't shy away from, kind of like the going to the back of the bus, you know, with Rosa Parks. If the day comes when I couldn't go to my state capitol and lobby, I would have to call the sheriff and say, I'm sorry, but I'll be at the capitol. You can find me there, and I'm going to be in this hearing room at this time. And if you got something you need to do, please come do it. Because I don't think the day's ever come when I can't petition my government for redress of my grievances and be a part of the lawmaking process that's open to the public. But there are some people out there who say, well, I can't even go to the Capitol because the Capitol's within a zone of advanced exclusion because if there's a daycare or something. I said, well, to me, that would be one I'd have to thumb my nose at.
Yeah. I'm also thinking of people that practice much more minority religions, things like Wiccan that are more involved at the Halloween timeframe. Someone that's a Christian denomination, Halloween has nothing to do with your religion, but someone that actually participates in kind of like pagan rituals, that would be literally the time of year that you would be practicing your religion. And now you're being prevented from practicing your religion directly related to the time of year.
Yes. And I think there are certainly First Amendment issues. There are freedom of expression, association. There's a lot of costumes and you're being prohibited from doing a lot of things that are constitutional right. I agree with you, and I agree with the caller that there should be legal action, and I would encourage him to work in that direction in Tennessee. But he goes back to his first. Are you done with this one? Because I was going back to his
one other is there a right to be able to move about and participate in commerce? Is this anything like being imprisoned, house arrest, because of this for an extended period of time for a crime you committed 20 years ago? You're not. I'm assuming this is also for people that are not under supervision. This is people just on the registry.
I would feel comfortable asserting such a right. I mean, there's a whole litany of things. But I was saying that these claims have to be put on paper, and they have to be filed in a court.
Right.
And a case has to be adjudicated. before we'll know the answer to some of these questions. We don't know if they can get away with this. As
far
as
I know,
Tennessee's the only state doing it.
I'm assuming it's 20-ish thousand people on the registry in Tennessee, that they lock up 20,000 people for 11 days and under house arrest, giving them a daylight kind of curfew.
And they can do it until they're stopped. That's
unbelievable. All right.
When you elect people, elections have consequences.
Yeah, no doubt.
But back to his first question about when does it rise to the level of being cruel and unusual punishment? There again, since the court is not a roving tribunal, the issue that he's raising about the violence, that has to be set forth in a civil complaint, that the registry is punitive because of this. And then specific instances have to be put in the complaint about how this is punitive.
Such as your house being shot up.
Yes, be prepared to show a direct correlation. Remember, the burden is on us as a challenger to show that the legislative branch got it wrong. Because it's presumed that they would not enact an unconstitutional statute.
And in this case, the guy said, I did it because they're sex offenders.
In this particular case, the proof would be more compelling. But then you start having to take some leaps of faith there. Have you been shot at since you've been on the registry? This is an isolated incident. If the state gets served with that complaint, they're going to say, well, we've got 20,000 people on the registry. And as far as we know, there's been 7 instances of harassment reported to us. So these are isolated incidents and they can be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. Now, this is not what I believe. This is what a defense attorney for the state of whatever you pick, Tennessee or whichever state it is, that's what they are going to say.
But if it saves one,
they're going to say to defend the statute, their job of the attorney general of the state of Tennessee is to defend the statutes that the legislature enacted and the governor pinned out as being the law. And they're going to think of everything they can to defend those laws. And some of it sometimes is disingenuous, and we're going to get to that later in Gundy. But yes, they will do their best to preserve this act by whatever means they can and to shoot down every argument you put forward. And the presumption is in their favor because the law is presumed constitutional.
But going specifically to this vigilante guy, the shots could have been fired, goes to the door, your kid is standing there just waiting to go outside and play with one of their friends. And now a bullet goes through the kid and kills the kid. It's an extreme example, but it seems highly plausible when you just have people randomly shooting at your house.
And we're getting more data. I mean, there's been enough killings to where these things are less and less isolated, and they can't hide that it's the registry causing it. But that's what they will try to do despite those, right? But it's up to us to assimilate all that data and go in. People in the registry are reluctant to report to the police, and I don't blame them, but they're reluctant to report to the police because they don't feel like the police give them a fair shake. I think we had that on a conference call not too long ago on Arsenal in Action. We had talked about that. People are reluctant to report these incidents to the police because they don't feel like the police are all that sympathetic. But the more data we have in terms of harassment, the better compelling case you can make when you're trying to assert the constitutional challenge that this is resulting in punishment, and it's state orchestrated punishment, because these are tools of the state that are being utilized to inflict that. So the state is complicit in harassment, discrimination, housing discrimination, employment discrimination. There's all sorts of things that the state is complicit in, but we're going to have to prove that. And that's what most people don't understand, is that the judge doesn't wake up one day and say, this shit's kind of bothering me.
And he can't say, hey, clerk, don't put this case on the docket for us to hear it next week. They can't initiate anything like that either.
No, there has to be a case in controversy between parties. So there has to be an aggrieved party.
Yeah.
And that aggrieved party bears the burden of proving. The state enjoys a presumption that you don't enjoy as the challenging party.
And what kind of cost do you think would go into these kind of challenges?
Well, it depends on whether you're going to need experts to prove your point. And if you're going to be needing experts, to prove some aspect of your assertions, then you're going to get into to some significant expenses. When you're talking about a case where experts are not necessary, then you can kind of do it a lot cheaper. You just got the poor attorney or the law firm's time and some negligible filing fees and maybe some deposition of state witnesses where you have to have a court reporter. But you're talking about $10,000 to easily six figures to $100,000 in the case of the McGuire case in Alabama. The attorney, as I recall, had well over $200,000 in out-of-pocket costs. He did a full-blown trial challenging the punitive nature of Alabama's registration scheme, which is one of the most punitive in the nation. And
what was the outcome of that?
As far as I know, he lost at the district court. He was in the federal court in district of one of the districts in Alabama, and he got a favorable finding on one claim that was there having requiring registration both with local. If you lived in a municipality, you had to register with the city and with the county. So the court struck that as being excessive, but they found everything else to be within a zone of a regulatory scheme. And last I checked, it was online on appeal at the 11th Circuit in Atlanta. And there had not been a decision rendered on that case, but he had over $1 million in billable hours had he been able to collect that. And he was representing his own brother in the case, but
I know which case you're talking about.
$1 million is really hard for most law firms to justify, even the larger law firms, to write off as uncollectible.
Right.
Even a
solo practitioner that makes a couple hundred grand a year, for them to then pro bono $1 million is 5 years of labor.
Yeah, and that's basically what this thing has been dragging on for years. And he also got some outfit out of D.C. to help with it, and part of that $1 million I think was for their billable hours. But if they don't win, those funds will never be collected, and so these challenges can be very expensive, and it always kind of tickles me when we live in a capitalist system and people don't recognize that capitalists have to be paid. I mean, you never get a pro bono furnace replacement. You never get a pro bono engine rebuild. You never get a pro bono anything except the lawyer. And the lawyer, you're willing to go in. I mean, when you go see a physician, you don't ask for pro bono. So there's some nice physicians out there that do write things off and take discounted rates. But there's no expectation of pro bono anything except with the legal profession. And if you're being wronged, there's this mentality that since I'm being the aggrieved party, I shouldn't have to pay for the remedy. And I've never quite understood how that comes about.
Well, let's go on to this article from The Guardian. There was a lot of shame. Meet the sex offender who is not a sex offender.
Now, we're going to get back to Gundy later. So the listener thinks we've forgotten about it. We haven't. So we're going to get back to his thing with Gundy. Okay.
This case comes out of New York, and this gentleman is on the sex offender registry and did not commit a sexual offense. He kidnapped. Can't say that that's really one of the better crimes that you could commit, but to that, kidnapping in my state could be like you say, hey, you, get over here. You intended to move that person forcibly. That could be attempted kidnapping. But because he did that, and this is only a couple years old, he's on the registry. What kind of strikes me in this article, though, is the claims he's making about the oppressive nature of him living in New York City. And there's got to be all kinds of stuff just right behind a wall somewhere. There's a daycare in some office building. You're just walking down the street and you can't be 1,000 feet from a park school daycare. There's got to be all kinds of stuff just hidden right behind a wall somewhere that no one would have any reason to be there, but everyone is just so densely populated, packed in there. What's 25 million people, 30 million people in New York City? That would be
not quite that many, but yeah.
Oh, well, it's more than there are people living in Nebraska, and but how it would be really hard to function in that kind of environment with everything being so, packed so tight. I'm assuming there could be a daycare on the 50th floor of a high rise. Does it count vertically also and horizontally?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I bet the answer is no. I bet they like compress that down. There's a daycare. You're on the corner. It's still 1,000 feet away. It's just up.
We'll have to get a New Yorker to let us know if they count vertical part of the measurement.
I bet you they don't. No one would have thought of that. Not when they wrote the state law, because, I mean, the rest of the state is basically flat. So they just considered as the crow flies, which I guess the crow could fly straight up. But anyway.
not indefinitely.
No, not indefinitely. Or peregrine? The ones that can go like 200 miles an hour straight down. But anyway, so a little digression there. But he can't, you know, he says, in addition to the 1,000-foot or 300 yards rule, they wrote it to where there's a 1,000-foot restriction and 300 yards, which is 900 feet. That seems a little odd to me. But he can't have animals. He can't hitchhike. He can't cross-dress.
Those are standard conditions for sex offenders.
So. Cross-dress? Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Or participate in sexual fantasies. And this guy kidnapped. He didn't do a sexual offense.
Well, but he's on the sex offender registry.
What's the connection of him not committing a sexual offense and being on the registry?
Well, there's a lot of states who encompass within the registered population of false imprisonment and kidnapping of a minor. And that was one of his victims of his shenanigans was 14. And he says he thought he was over that, but he was 14 and he was trying to extract ransom. And so that puts him in a zone of a crime against a child. And that's a registrable offense. So the supervising authorities for the period of his supervision are putting standard sex offender conditions on him. And it said there's like 48 conditions of 1,000 feet, and then the 300-yard rules, which I'm a little unclear on the 300-yard rule. Did you understand that?
I saw it in passing as I was reading through it, and I was like, are they just writing 300 because it's kind of sort of 1,000 feet? But no, I mean, it's listed as a separate thing. Another one on here, I will not submit to any medical procedures meant to enhance my sexual functioning, such as penile implants. Like, what? Does that mean you can't take Viagra?
That's what it means, yes.
I'm baffled at, like, there is a mountain of evidence to show how good getting the release would be. And then, of course, having relationships with people, like legitimate adult mature relationships. And go live in a box, don't come out. That's just how all this stuff feels. It doesn't feel very well thought through as far as how an individual is supposed to function post your prison time.
Well, this is a case where I'm going to try to make contact with the legal team and see if it's anything that they might want an amicus brief on. But yeah, it seems kind of common sense. If you're going to be in the sex offender registry, you should probably have had a sex offense, but that's not the way it is.
It seems like, yeah, I mean, just like the lady in Virginia that I always bring up, just, hey, I didn't report that my kid was having sex, so I'm on the registry. She would be subjected to similar rules and regulations that she would have to follow because she didn't report that her kid had sex. So she can't go cross-dressing.
Well, they may not have that rule there, but this the 300 yards is places where children congregate. So you've got 1,000 feet of school grounds and then 300 yards are where children congregate. Now, just out of curiosity, do you have a yardstick with you everywhere when you're going? Do you?
I know. Yeah, and how? So 300 yards, that's three football fields. And in New York City, good grief.
It says they could be standing crash on one side of a Manhattan block and the other side of the building, totally unbeknownst to him, there could be a playground skating rink.
You would literally have the entire city of New York blocked off to sex offenders with those conditions. There's just no way. Anyway, so that's a fun article about, I can't even figure out how those, and they only list six of the 47 of the 48 things. And I shall be in my approved residence between the hours of 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. And I'm assuming that this is while he's under supervision, that this doesn't apply afterwards. And I don't remember seeing how long he's on supervision for. I mean, if it's a year or 2 years, it's kind of tolerable. I'm not saying it's good.
He's been kind of a bad boy, so he may have.
They do say that.
Yeah, he's been.
He might have a fairly extensive, he might have a pretty long sentence going on for him then.
So he might very well have a long period of time, but I'm going to read this federal lawsuit and see what I can make of it.
Well, that's a fun one. Let's move on to the Washington, who says it? Mark Levin Compost? Is that who says this?
What kind of wacky weed are you smoking tonight?
Oh, okay, wacky weed. Mark Levin, the super duper conservative screaming talk show host. Yeah, he calls it the Washington Compost.
Yes, that's Mark Levin who uses that.
This article is from the Washington Post. Don't forget about Kavanaugh's troubling legal philosophy. This one goes a little bit more into the propeller head side of things that you will be far more adept at covering than me. But just how the different justices and how they, I mean, it would be hard to argue that none of them know how the Constitution is written, but then they would all then latch onto the various methods and ideologies behind the Constitution and so forth on how they would side with things. So tell us what you think about what's going on here.
Well, I put it in here because it gives me a chance to talk about a lot of our people think they're for things that they're really not for, but they sound good. The law is very confusing, and you hear these simple phrases like a strict interpretation, a textualist, an originalist, and to the average person that sounds good, yeah, because you grew up thinking the founders were such geniuses that they got everything right, and that there's no need for us to even second guess anything, and you think that those phrases that you believe in those phrases, but what's flawed about that thinking is that it doesn't take into account how society evolves, and the evolving standards of things that we would not tolerate today that we would have tolerated back in colonial times. And so this appointment, he may be a textualist, and to some people that sounds really, really fantastic, except for when we have the situation like we had in Nebraska with the case we talked about, I think, two podcasts in a row, because I was so fascinated about the case where the conservative state Supreme Court in Nebraska, they did a textualist interpretation of the statute, and the textualist interpretation did include by literal reading, a person who an adjudicated juvenile in another state who locates, if you are a person, which language says anyone who locates to Nebraska while who is required to register in another state, another jurisdiction or territory of the United States has to register in Nebraska. And so the textualist said, well, they could have said anyone other than an adjudicated juvenile. They didn't say that. So therefore, we're going straight by the text. And if they want to carve out an exception for juveniles, they can do that. Well, that's the risk you run with a textualist. When you don't consider intent or the purpose of the law, then you can come out with some rather troubling results. And it is true that the Nebraska legislature can fix that, but at what cost and what damage to the individuals? If the state lights them up like a Christmas tree, which they're planning to do, as soon as they can get District Judge Koff's injunction lifted, how much damage will be done while we're waiting for the Nebraska legislature to fix it, assuming that they're inclined to fix it, even though they don't register juveniles in Nebraska that are adjudicated in the state of Nebraska? How much damage is going to be done? Well, I put this article in here because this is one of the follies of textualism. You think you're for it. You think you're for originalism. Well, if you're for originalism, then you cannot oppose the death penalty, because the death penalty was widely used in colonial times. There was nothing cruel and unusual about it as far as the execution of a person who had received due process of law. It's only through the evolving standards of decency that we've come to realize that we get it wrong and we make mistakes, and that the system is rather the way people put to death can be very barbaric, and we don't, as a civilized society, think that it's best to do that. The whole world, as far as the civilized nations, none of them that I'm aware of have a death penalty.
But doesn't that even go to like the 11 through 27 amendments? The first 10 were there pretty much from the start. So if you were to take an originalist point of view, wouldn't 11 through 27 be ones that you go, that would include women having the right to vote, which would include minorities having the right to vote?
Well, you're not for those things. I don't agree with that, because the originalists would give way to legitimate amendments. The Constitution provides a way to amend itself. So even the most originalists would say that if the people have gone through that troublesome process to do an amendment, then you would no longer believe in the original. If you would believe in the originals plus the amended language.
Okay, so they will accept the amendments as far as being originalists too.
Well, because that's what the originalists provided, a process to change the Constitution. They didn't want it to be completely stagnant. They wanted to provide a mechanism for adjustments, but they wanted it to be a very difficult document to change.
Right. It feels to me that if you're going to say I'm an originalist and I stand by what the founders wanted, well, the founders wanted it to be modified. It has been modified. Therefore, you would have to change what the original intent was.
Well, you can do that. I mean, we could abolish the death penalty just like we abolished prohibition. And,
right.
And Scalia wouldn't have any problem with that if we did a constitutional amendment to abolish the death penalty. But he doesn't want to do it through judicial fiat because he's legislating from the bench. And he's saying, hey, if you people find the death penalty that objectionable, then you need to do something. My robe doesn't entitle me to do that something. And so a lot of our people have things that they don't like that are public policy questions. They're not constitutional questions. And they get mad because the judges don't do something. And for them to do something would be them to be legislating from the bench. It's not, you can't have it both ways. And that's the point I put of this article in here. Since our audience tends to be on the conservative side, I suspect that more people listening to us are happy that he's been confirmed. But don't be shocked if you get decisions that you can't explain because you'll say, well, gee, that's not fair. Well, that's not for him. That's not for his role. He's not to save you from a bad public policy that you enact. He's only to save you from a literally unconstitutional action. And not agreeing with something doesn't make it unconstitutional.
Right. Yeah, I do understand. I've run out of ideas as far as questions to ask you because I'm now on your side, I guess. It always comes back to we are the ones that voted for the people that represented us that made the law that we now don't like, and now we're expecting that the judge would come in there and he's the ninth inning pitcher, whatever the heck they're called. And come in and rescue us from something that we're like, oh shit, we didn't really mean to do this. Well, you did mean to. That's how you voted. That's how you got where you are. And that's what we've got. And it's our fault. And we have to then go get our legislator to change what we like the Halloween stupidness. We voted for the legislators in Tennessee to say, yeah, we think that an 11-day house arrest is okay. And until we go say, no, that's not okay, then we get to get locked up at 6 o'clock for the 11 days leading up to Halloween.
And there's a potential of a constitutional challenge there that might gain some traction. But it's a whole lot better if you don't make these public policies to start with. Because just because you don't like it doesn't make it unconstitutional. I happen to believe there's some unconstitutional aspects of that. But every bad public policy
is
not unconstitutional. So the black robes do not come in as a neutral party and say, well, we're going to second guess what the lawmakers did because this just doesn't seem quite fair to us, or there seems to be a more efficient way. I could have thought of a better way to do that. That if you truly are an originalist and you believe in judges who don't legislate from the bench, then you could not be supportive of a judge nullifying the will of the people.
Right.
But it's only the will of the people that you don't agree with that you want nullified.
And we have batted around the registry itself is not unconstitutional because we register kids for schools, we register cars, we have driver's license, we have regulatory schemes of speed limits and so forth. These things unto themselves are not unconstitutional.
Well, but let's be clear. Merely requiring a person to register in some type of registration scheme is not unconstitutional.
Right.
Now most registration schemes of sex offenders, I would argue, are very punitive and very unconstitutional. But you could conceivably devise a sex offender registration scheme that would not inflict any punishment, therefore would not be violative of the Constitution. The draft registration scheme, all young men are subjected to that. And I've never heard anybody say it's punitive.
Right.
You have to.
Because you just go down there, you just give them your name, address, phone number so that they can call you if it's time. That's the end of it.
That's the end of it. And then you get penalized by ineligibility for financial aid and various things that are sanctioned against you if you can't prove that you are connected with a selective service between your 18th and 26th birthday. But that mere act of forcing a person to register is not unconstitutional. So you could devise a sex offender registry, although I am not advocating for that. You could do that. You could have a scheme
where it would be so benign that the requirements would be so minuscule that no one could argue that it's putative. If it was not lit up to the public and you didn't have any obligations and restrictions of where you could go, where you could work, and you merely had to do what you do for selective service, and you were allowed to go online and change your address when your address changed, I don't think it would be easy to argue that that's putative.
And I don't, you know, they're not taking like DNA swabs. You just, I mean, the post office, last I remember, is where you went and did it. Or maybe the DMV.
I think they've evolved now where you can even do it online, but I'm so
perhaps,
old.
Perhaps.
Not an issue for me. But you can have registration schemes that are not unconstitutional. So to say the registry of sex offenders is automatically unconstitutional is foolhardy, because it isn't. It's just that the registration schemes we have in place are unconstitutional. But you could devise one that isn't.
So one more time, Larry, you are saying that you're in favor of registries? Could you clarify?
I said the opposite. I said I don't have any support for registries. But you cannot expect the courts to end registration because they can't end them because the mere act of registering. If you go too far and you tip the balance and it becomes punitive, the lawmakers have every prerogative to come back and peel off some of those requirements and see if they can contour a registry scheme that is not punitive. That's what they will do in Michigan. That's what they do in most states where there's a court opinion that says that they can't do that. And then they come back and say, well, but we'll try this. They don't just throw up their hands and say, well, we give up.
Yeah, still. Yeah, I mean, just with all the extra stuff that they add onto it makes it the challenging part. Not that your information is gathered, but that it's easily publicly available for some schmuck to come and shoot up your house and potentially kill your family members. And that guy was also vandalizing cars and mailboxes. But also the aspect that you have to go to the police station to get booked under penalty, like with the tiny little 3-day window. But if you had to just go online and register, you could even take a selfie photo if they wanted to really update your photo that bad. There are just a bazillion ways that you could pull it off without all the extra baggage that goes along with it.
It's clearly designed to be more than just a non-punitive regulatory scheme. The people who design these schemes, with the help of the victim's advocate and the law enforcement apparatus, they are deliberately trying to inflict as much humiliation as they can. They can't say that, and sometimes they do say it mistakenly. I think in the case of the state of Georgia, when they went so far a few years ago that their registry almost got struck down, one of the assembly members said that we hope to make it so horrible in Georgia they won't want to leave. And that's kind of clear. Yes. The legislative intent.
I do recall hearing something about that. It was hearsay, but I do recall something along those lines.
Yes. He was dumb enough to say on the House floor that hopefully they will leave. So, all righty.
Well, then the next article is from Vox.com, and this is a quote from President Trump. It's a very scary time for young men in America, but women are doing great, is the subtitle. So, this whole big thing with the hearings, and you had the accuser and the accusee, and so Trump's out there, and he was saying that he's been accused of stuff, and that's probably fair game. I mean, as you rise of levels of success, you become a larger and larger profile target, and there's 30 something like that allegations against Trump. No idea how many are true or false. Not the point, but he is saying that, you know, it's just there's nothing to it for someone to come out of the woods and go, hey, you did this to me 30 years ago, and we should now dredge up this whole thing. And so, you know, kids in college, people get drunk, people do make terrible decisions, and now you get accused of things. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, and it's horrible that it does. But without evidence, someone could say, I got abducted by aliens. You have no evidence. What are you supposed to do about it?
Well, I agree with Trump on this. If we ditch all requirements that the accusing party have evidence, then it would be a scary time, not only for young men. It would be a scary time for old men. It'd be a scary time for women, because if we no longer need evidence, and the burden is on the accused, we're in a very dangerous posture in terms of we're throwing out our entire system.
There's a link in the article that points to another one that says that the research has found that false rape allegations are very rare. But even still, if there's an allegation, you have to, there has to be evidence, or else, like you say, you're going to put someone in a box. So you're just supposed to say, yes, he touched me in the wrong way and I felt icky about it. Now you get to go sit in a box for a year, 5 years, 20 years.
That's the way some would want it. And I disagree with that. And I'm sure I alienate people from saying that, but I believe wholeheartedly that our system got it right when it said that the burden is on the accused. I mean, on the accuser, not the accused. The burden, the presumption is on the accused is innocent. And that follows them all the way to the conclusion of the trial and the pronouncement of the verdict. And, mm-hmm. If you don't have evidence, and the sexual crimes, we've had this discussion before, is the only place where we would tolerate this. I mean, yeah. We can go through a litany of crimes, and domestic violence, I've talked about it before, is extremely underreported. But when there's a dispatch for domestic violence, there has to be evidence of domestic violence. Now, I can't say that the evidence is always legit. It is possible a person can self-inflict, but there has to be evidence of the violence before there is a charge of domestic violence. We would never tolerate a victim of domestic violence coming in 26 years later, 32 years later, whatever this was, 32 years later, I think.
36.
36 years later. Oh, well, I'll soon later get it right. We would never tolerate that and say, oh, we're going to charge with domestic violence. Does that mean that you're not sympathetic to people who are victims of domestic violence, both men and women? Which the predominance is, of course, is women. But of course you're sympathetic to them. It's tragedy that there's violence taking place and that people are not being held accountable. But we can't go back years later and create a fair adversarial process. Because the people that lived in the apartment next door that heard the pictures falling off of the walls are not there anymore. The evidence just doesn't exist anymore that would have supported the charge. It's tragic that you didn't come forward. It's tragic that you had domestic violence inflicted on you for 10 years. But there's not anything we can do about it from a legal perspective.
One similarity, though, it seems, is we were just speaking of our people, the registrants, not making claims to the police because they're like, oh, hey, you're on the registry, F you get to get harassed. So now you're reluctant to come through and make some kind of allegation, even if it's true, you know. And so this seems to be the same thing. Many of the women are saying that they don't feel comfortable or they're not believed. They don't want, I mean, this Dr. Ford woman, she's been doxxed. She's been threatened. She's had death threats. No one should ever be subjected to all that. If she has a legit claim, let her come out and make her claim. There's no reason to go turn around and trash the woman's reputation. On the flip side, let her make her claim.
Well, and she made it.
She did. But then, but just the collateral damage of doing it, people get doxxed all the time in this modern era.
I'm familiar with the concept.
Yeah. And that's a very cowardly way of handling your issues with someone also.
Yes.
I mean, that's effectively making a public registry over someone.
Yeah. I would say to the people who dox, you are total losers.
Yeah.
To go stooping for someone's personal information to release it to try to hurt them shows your total lack of character. You are doing nothing that's positive for society. You're a losing individual if that's all you can do. If you can't engage, rather than doxing me, call the podcast and let's have a conversation about these issues. But otherwise, I consider you a failure in life, and I don't intend to stop the podcast because of that. So I'll go ahead and say, yes, I'm one of the doxed, and I have the same reaction Mitch McConnell has to it. And my reaction is, you're a loser.
Did he say that?
He did. He said, I mean, he didn't use that exact terminology, but he spoke very, very strongly on the Senate floor about it. And he said that it would not stop him from doing his job.
And, didn't Lindsey Graham, wasn't he one of the other ones that got doxxed in the last week or so?
There was quite a few of them that have gotten doxxed. Now, the people are being prosecuted for it.
The Senate did go around and do something about it?
Yeah, yes, there's already been at least one arrest because of that, and there are illegal actions taking place. You can't just put everybody's personal information out There are certain things you can't put out. But like I say, these people feel proud of themselves. Kind of like the guy that shot the place up. He's a loser.
Do you think that's going to drive any interest from their end to legislate something?
I would hope that that it would. I think the opportunity is there. When you try to do public policy, when you're talking about interfering with businesses, the assimilation of this data is big business, and the marketing that takes place as a result of this data is big business. To legislate that remedy is going to be very careful, and conservatives will have a lot more leeway to do that because they're presumed to never want to interfere with business because they're pro business, you see, and they understand business, and they get a license to do things. It works both ways. There are things that conservatives would like to do, only a liberal can do, and vice versa. But I think that since this happened to the conservative wing, they will be more tolerance granted to them to impose restrictions on business in terms of what they have to do when there's a dox, how quickly they have to remove it, maybe looking at the criminal penalty scheme in terms of whether there's federal penalties that can be levied. I think it's a good time to have the discussion. I think it may move things forward. But the conservatives that have been doxed are not very happy about it right now.
Yeah, no kidding. And maybe that'll have a chilling effect. Maybe if they get prosecuted to some degree, maybe.
I'm hoping there's so much of it. It's like everything with internet crime. The apprehension rate is so low. I think that the reward, it'll still be happening. But if you lock up enough people, which is not my first solution for every problem, but if you're going to try to ruin people's lives and put their family in jeopardy, this what they're doing to the Republicans, I can't condone that. I didn't support his confirmation, but to try to incite violence against people who are doing their job that were elected by their states, that's sick. That is really sick.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to incite violence against this woman that made the accusations, that's sick. She has been through whatever she's gone through, and none of us know what she's gone through, and we don't know what's motivating her if it's not true. If it's not true, I think that Kavanaugh's daughter had it best. Pray for her.
Right. And if it's not true, then you would have a civil suit of slander and all that.
So, how do you prove it's not true, though?
Well, isn't that the same burden? It's the same burden of proof.
Well, when you're doing defamation, though, the public person has a far fewer protections against defamation, and so him getting anything from Forward is that's not going to happen.
Sure. Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. The next article does come from the Washington Post, so that's a twofer for Washington Post tonight. And this is Betsy DeVos vows campus sexual assault rules will be fair to all sides. This is, she's the education secretary and a very wealthy woman, huge donor to the GOP. And she was in Georgia, and this is about them. So I guess during the Obama administration, things got slanted more towards the accuser side of sexual misconduct, particularly on campuses. And this is Betsy DeVos talking about bringing some sort of balance back, that the accused also has more balance, I guess you could say.
I think we've talked about this before. This is one of the few things I'm in total agreement with the administration, and I'm hoping that they go through with these changes. I think that the Obama administration went too far in the wrong direction in terms of presuming that every accused is guilty, and some of the demands of the Me Too movement have been over the top. And I'm glad to see that we're headed this direction.
I've read articles. I started reading articles about this in like Reason magazine. It's I never want to quote unquote victim blame either, but it's just really easy that so you go to a party and you get drunk and you do something with maybe someone that you're not approving of if you weren't drunk. So now you make an accusation to try and save face to some degree. And these are barely not minors anymore. And now you're going to saddle both sides with all this baggage going through the whole process. It's just, and who's supposed to be in charge of a legal proceeding? Should the college be in charge of the legal proceeding, or should it just go straight to the prosecutor's office? This is a really, really complex issue.
Well, it's both. I mean, what the university chooses to do. I mean, most large universities and colleges do have a police force for criminal conduct mm-hmm. that occurs on campus, but the educational response in terms of if a person has had an accusation, whether or not there's criminal charges, these are people that are being kicked out of school. Their mm-hmm. reputation is being destroyed, and without any process whatsoever. I mean, it's alleged that them having the basic confrontation of the accuser, that's too traumatic. I'm sorry. It has to be that way. You have to come forward and you have to make these accusations where the person can see what they're responding to, and they need to be able to cross-examine you. I'm sorry. That's the way it needs to be. If you want to call that re-victimization, you can call it that, but I consider it due process of law. I don't consider it re-victimization.
Yeah, it's literally in the Constitution that you have the right to face your accuser.
And you're taking something. I don't think you can argue that an education, as expensive as it is, and the opportunity to remain in the institution with some sort of due process, I don't think you can claim that that's an insignificant thing if you're going to take away a person's education because of an accusation without any due process. I don't know how right. you can sleep with yourself thinking that we're a great nation that would do that.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Hey, are you ready for like our asshole of the week article?
Sure. I think I know where you're headed.
We're headed down to Miami. And this is the Miami New Times. Cop who locked Darren Rainey in scalding shower until he died keeps having sex on duty. So this officer was a corrections officer. I guess in Miami, is that Miami-Dade County maybe down that way?
Yes. Yes.
And him and his cohorts there at the jail or prison, and they took a guy who was 50 years old. He was schizophrenic, and he was just serving a 2-year sentence for some cocaine possession. Not really. I mean, you know, maybe it's a big deal to some, but I mean, it seems kind of insignificant to me. They left him in a shower screaming for 2 hours. This is a shower stall where the officers had easy direct access to control the temperature of it. So maybe they jacked it up to 180 degrees. They leave the guy in there for 2 hours. And when they finally went back in there, his skin was peeling off and the man was dead. And what do you do with someone like that? You give him a job on the police force, of course. And now he's going around and on his watch time, on his shift time, he's over at some woman's house, maybe for an hour or 2 hours. And maybe they're having inappropriate relationships while he's on duty.
Wow.
That's quality stuff, man. That is a stellar, stellar human being right there.
Yeah, it's I don't know how you.
I don't know why you talk about police overreach.
I don't know how you could. How could you be in a room next to someone dying and screaming because you're inflicting pain on them and not be moved by that? I mean, what type of individual? If this is true, and it looks like Internal Affairs validated it, and he got fired, how could you do that?
Well, this is, you know, an almost identical article to the police transport one we covered 6 months ago, where they were pooping and peeing on each other in the van with no air conditioning and no food. It's the same sort of thing. How are you the person that is willing to put that punishment on people?
Wow. Well, apparently he's been rehired by another agency.
That's what you do with these people. That's awesome. Never any criminal charges. I mean, he's complicit in the death of a man. How does that not bring charges? That would be the DA's office that doesn't bring charges, correct?
It would be, but it's difficult to get a conviction on anything like this, as we found out with all the many attempts. We just recently got one in Laquan, if I pronounce it right, McDonald in Chicago, but you seldom can convict officers. They get the benefit of all the doubt.
This is also a married individual, and they have photos of him at his girlfriend's house, you know, with rose petals on the bed and him sitting on the floor in his officer's uniform. It looks like he's throwing down some sort of food or something. That's good times right there. I mean, that is a prize winning person right there. That should, I don't know, Nobel Peace Prize material, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I think this was good to talk about from the accountability point of view. We had the conviction in Chicago, and he was immediately taken into custody. The officer that shot 16 bullets into Laquan's body.
Right. I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah. Conviction, of course, it's not for first degree. He's facing anything from, I think they said, from probation up to 6 years for the actual death. But at least there's some accountability there. We're not going to stop this until there's accountability from the officers, for the officers. And that accountability comes from us as the citizens. If you sit on a jury, don't assume that the police officer can do no harm, do no wrong. Don't assume that, don't give them all the benefit of the doubt. You go where the evidence takes you.
Yeah. And
like the one in Vegas that got shot in, that was wearing a pair of skimpy briefs.
Boxers.
Right. Yeah. And crawling backwards, and it got shot by the jury didn't convict him.
I think it's a fair argument that you should never die at the hands of police, except for in the most extreme circumstances. The rule that if the police feel fear, that gives them the fatal, what's the word I'm looking for? They have lethal authority if they feel threatened. That is garbage. I mean, I'm sure if you're like in a gang ridden town, then maybe the rules should change, but I don't know, dude.
Maybe the rule like the citizens have, that you can't use deadly force unless your life is in jeopardy, and that reasonable fear has to be what a reasonable person would fear in the same or similar circumstances. Well, I can't see how with a machine gun and you've got a guy on his hands and knees with a pair of panties on, I don't know how you would be. I don't know how you would feel fear when you can clearly see there's no weaponry anywhere on his body.
Yeah, unless he's suitcasing it.
So it's like, really? That's not a reasonable fear. I can't say what was going through his head. He may be so paranoid that he was psychologically not fit for the police department. But that fear was not reasonable. And if they would apply that standard, then perhaps maybe we could convict some of these people.
Yeah, but there is that different standard that if they just have the threat, something, just that little bit of fear, then they can use lethal force.
That's what I'm saying. That should be done away with, and they should use the same standard that's used for an ordinary citizen. When you use self-defense, you've got to show that your response was reasonable in view of the totality of the circumstances, and that reasonability is determined by how another person faced with the same or similar circumstances would react. And I would not shoot a person who's wearing a pair of skimpy shorts that has clearly no weapons anywhere and is on their knees. I just can't see a fear that's reasonable there.
And 16 shots? I mean, did he say bang, 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 stop, bang, 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 bang?
That's
a lot of shots to get hit with. Did all of them hit the victim?
Yeah, I think in the case of Laquan, it was 16 that hit him.
Jesus, him. That could have been more that didn't.
Just a teenage boy running. And I get on my soapbox about police misconduct. If you want to fire me up, that's one that does it.
We talked about, what was I just going to say? We talked about something recently. Oh man, I just lost my train of thought when I yawned.
Because you got old timers.
I know. I totally have old timers. All right. So now I have to mark something that I have to clip out. Well, then from Slate, liberals courted Neil Gorsuch's, would that be Gorsuch's? How do you pluralize Gorsuch? Liberals courted Neil Gorsuch's vote to strike down a terrible sex offender law. They're playing with fire. They're let's touch on this first. So this is about the Gundy case. But the first thing in this article that I want to hit right off the bat is it says, so the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, SORNA, a draconian 2006 law that established a national sex offender registry. You have some thoughts on that right there.
Well, there is no national sex offender registry.
You mean the 800,000 of us, we're not going to the federal registration office and giving them our information?
That is correct. There is no national sex offender registry. There is a national search vehicle that where you can search the nation's registries to try to find a person who's registered and who's publicly listed on one of the states or one of the territories' registries. But there is no national sex offender registry.
That's fascinating. So here we are in this article. I mean, Slate's a pretty big publication, and they at least got that little detail wrong. But so let's pull back to Gundy. And this is, I would definitely need you to describe, tell me what Gundy is.
Well, it's a case that's on certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they just had oral arguments this past week. Mr. Gundy was a convicted offender who moved from, I believe, Pennsylvania to New York, and he didn't register as a sex offender in the state of New York. And the United States prosecuted him because he traveled in interjurisdictional, what they refer to interstate commerce. He traveled interjurisdictionally and didn't register in New York, didn't present himself for registration. So therefore, he committed a federal crime. And he was a pre-act offender. And when I say pre-act offender, his sex offense occurred prior to the adoption of the Adam Walsh Child Safety Act of 2006. So you had a federal prosecution for a crime of traveling, and it was applied, that crime was to a pre-act offender. And it gets very nuanced because you've got a class of people who committed their sex offenses pre-2006, and then you've got everyone who committed their offense post-2006 from the adoption of the Adam Walsh Act forward.
Do you want to try and hit on who this actually impacts? So, I mean, when this came out, I was sitting on my couch, like watching TV or something, and somebody starts lighting up my phone with asking me, he's like, well, what does Gundy mean? And Hank started writing in about, oh God, here we go with Gundy. Here we go. Okay. So someone that is convicted in California and they were convicted in California state court in 2002. And I don't know. And they're off supervision and it's 2018 and they moved to Nebraska. Does this impact them?
It very well could impact that person because they would be a pre-act offender.
And all right.
Under the federal law, they would have a duty to register in Nebraska as long as Nebraska wants them to register. But they must report into Nebraska registration authorities and register. If they don't, they're violating federal law. And what's really confusing people is the 2006 Adam Walsh Act, we probably should cover that. It did not create sex offender registration. Registration has been around since 1947 in California, and then 1990s, I think 1990 or 91 in Washington State. And then all throughout the 90s, the rest of the states adopted some version of registration. I think maybe 97, 98 was the last state that adopted a registry, which means that you already have an obligation to register prior to the Adam Walsh Act. The states already had registration schemes. So when you look at 2006, that did not create the duty to register. But what the Walsh Act was dealing with was many things, and one of them was a group of missing sex offenders who had traveled interjurisdictionally, and the state that they had traveled from was happy that they were gone, because even with a low rate of recidivism, it's even lower if they're not in your state. So that state celebrated the fact that they were gone, and the state that they had traveled to didn't know they were there because they didn't present themselves. You had an off-the-grid situation where people could opt out. And
in order to try to do something about that, there was a criminal component inserted, a criminal statute inserted into federal law that those who travel intrajurisdictionally can be federally prosecuted because the feds have vastly superior resources. And if you disappeared from Alabama, even though Alabama was celebrating, the sheriff there has popped several bottles of champagne. Champagne. And celebrated your departure. That's not, according to most people, a sound national policy. For even though you've got a sheriff celebrating that they're not committing their sex offenses there, wherever they've gone to, they need to be identified, tracked down, and found. So the federal apparatus comes in and says, well, we've got you federally, similar to the interstate flight to avoid prosecution. You interstate moved and you didn't register in the new state, so therefore we're going to charge you. Well, the Adam Walsh Act delegated to the Attorney General of the United States authority to determine how they're going to deal with pre-act offenders, and the pre-act offender is anyone whose offense occurred prior to that date. Well, if you've got the argument was there was 100,000 missing. Who knows what the real number was? But there were sex offenders missing. Well, any attorney general serving the United States government, regardless of which president, it could have been Janet Reno, it could have been Eric Holder, it could have been Robert Kennedy. Any attorney general given the power to decide whether or not to apply. I mean, can you imagine what would have been said if the attorney general had said, well, one of the reasons why they passed this darn thing was to get the 100,000 missing sex offenders back in the system. But I'm going to kind of give them a free pass, and I'm not going to worry about them. I'm going to worry about people who travel from this day forward. I don't think that attorney general would be very popular, regardless if it was Reno or if it was Holder. And so any attorney general that was given the discretion to decide what to do about pre-act offenders, they were going to decide to go out and try to find the pre-act offenders who had vanished and prosecute them. Well, that's what happened in Gundy's case. And Gundy's arguing that was an improper thing for the attorney general to do, to be given by Congress the authority to determine how to deal with pre-act offenders. Congress should have guided the law enforcement and given them precision instructions of how they wanted this. And Congress didn't make those decisions. They went ahead and said the attorney general can figure out. So the attorney general not only decided to federally prosecute the people who were pre-act that traveled interstate, the attorney general also recommended to the states that, as far as I'm concerned, I give you a recommendation. It's not binding. It's just merely a recommendation that you can apply all the enhancements that the federal law is recommending to your pre-act offenders. Because what the states could have done, they could have applied the new registration standards to only people convicted or who committed criminality, sexual crimes after 2006. They could have said, we're going to have an old registry that lasts 10 years and it's law enforcement only for the old people. And we're going to have a new registry for the new people that have these enhanced requirements that are 15, 25 for life. And you have to report more frequently. And you have to give us more information. That would kind of undermine the efficacy of whatever legislation you have. Arguably, if these enhancements were going to make the system more effective, it would take many, many years before the number of post-act offenders would equal the number of pre-act offenders. So you would have a registration scheme where the states would have a group of people that would have to register for 10 years, like, for example, Nebraska, and they would automatically roll off of the registry and they would be non-public except for the ones that were risk rated level 3. Well, that disserved the purpose of SORNA because the feds were wanting to get most everybody publicly listed. So the attorney general said, as far as I'm concerned, you're good to go on applying these new requirements to the pre-act offenders. Now, this did create your obligation to register. This said, go ahead, and in my opinion, you can apply these more harsh conditions to the pre-act offenders because it's still a civil regulatory scheme. Well, you had states chomping at the bit, Ohio first, and then I think 18 now, who have applied those more rigorous standards, and they've applied them to the pre-act offenders, except for in states where the courts have come in and said you can't do that. But in my opinion, if Gundy goes the way that we're hoping it goes, that won't nullify what the states have done, because the states have put these requirements on the person. The state right. legislative acts will not be nullified by this, because this is a challenge to a federal law. The federal component is in play here on the interstate travel. And I forget the section number, but it's like 18 U.S.C. 2250 or something like that. But whatever that section is of the federal law that provides for a federal prosecution, that's what's before the U.S. Supreme Court, which narrows down what Gundy would do dramatically. What Gundy would do for the sex offenders would be that anyone who's had a federal prosecution that's a pre-act offender, meaning their crime occurred prior to 2006, they would be able to come back and say, well, that conviction should not stand because the Supreme Court decided that the Attorney General could not prescribe that I could be prosecuted. And they could arguably have, if they set aside Gundy's conviction, anybody who fits that fact pattern could have their federal conviction set aside. And that would include people who are still on supervised release. The federal sentences tend to be lengthy for violating the registry. It's up to 120 months. So there, right. could be a significant number of people who are imprisoning or either on supervised release. Those people would arguably be entitled to relief. So it's very important to them. It's very important to them. If you're having to report to a federal probation office and you're having to have all these conditions imposed upon you as a result of this conviction, it's very important. There could be spinoff beyond that, where it could be those federal convictions can be used in state court to enhance you. So say a person got convicted in 2008 for traveling in interstate commerce, and they served 3 years in federal prison and their own supervised release, and they picked up a state charge because they couldn't find a job, and they picked up a state felony charge, and the state used that felony as an enhancing tool, and they gave them a very lengthy prison sentence in the state. Well, arguably, I would think that if the federal statute was ruled invalid and it eradicated that conviction for the federal SORNA, if that was the vehicle that enhanced the person, I would say that you could go back to court. That wouldn't nullify your conviction for whatever the felonious activity you did, but you could arguably get the enhancement removed if that provided the enhancement tool. So that, right. that's another group of people that would be possibly entitled to relief. And then you've got states like Texas, where the people petition for removal and the attorney general comes in and says, well, we would be happy to remove them. But if we were to remove them, the federal standards are 15 and 25. And this person has a tier two offense if we look at the federal tiering. So therefore, they're not eligible for removal. I think you could make a credible argument that even though the argument is already specious and bullshit, you could make a very compelling argument that since Gundy has overturned the Attorney General's recommendation and the way the Attorney General decided to go forward with SORNA, there's some impact, but it's going to be very modest. It's not going to make the registry unconstitutional. And I hate to say that on this podcast, because I know that there are people that are disappointed with that, but the impact is going to be very modest. The much larger impact this is going to have is where the real meat is, and that's on the delegation. Congress does a lot of delegating to administrative agencies, and conservatives, particularly on things that they disagree with, don't like the Environmental Protection Agency. The oil industry feels like they're trapped with too much burdensome red tape with all these rules they have to go with that have never been enacted right. through Congress. You've got the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. You've got the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You've got all these agencies where they promulgate stuff without it being going through Congress. That's where there's going to be a whole lot more. If you get a conservative alignment on the Supreme Court and they look beyond the scare tactics that the Solicitor General argued and when were held, saying that this would create registry-free zones, it would not do that. But if you get beyond all that, those specious and those red herrings that they threw out there, and if they decide to rein in the delegation clause and give more precision in terms of what can be delegated, that's where there's going to be a much more dramatic impact. In my view, the impact on the sex offenders is going to be relatively modest. It's a step in the right direction.
Right.
But I don't see it as being this cure-all, end-all that people are hoping for. And I've seen a lot of electronic traffic about how this is going to be the beginning of the end. It's going to be a beginning, but I think the end is going to be some time away.
And I mean, for the vast majority of people, you got, I mean, it's been 12 years since the AWA kicked in. I would think that the majority of the people on the registry have been convicted since then. This does little to nothing to help them.
Well, if they're a post-act offender, this particular case, I don't see how would be of much use, because clearly you've got plenty of advance notice that you have to register. There's a federal statute that will swoop in and prosecute you if you don't. So if you're a post-act offender and you travel interjurisdictionally, then I don't see how this is going to be of much use to you. But the people are missing, and please don't miss them. There's a state registry. New York could have already prosecuted him had they known he was there. They didn't know he was there because he didn't report in. And this doesn't do anything about state prosecutions. It's already against the law. If Nevada has a broad enough registry, and they have one of the broader ones that goes back a long ways, if their registry requires you to register, if your offense is covered by their definition, whether or not the feds prosecute you, Nevada can prosecute you for failing to register. Now, the time of the sentence in both states is not as long as what the feds hand out, but the states can properly prosecute you. And I don't see anything that would preclude. Here's what's going to happen. If they declare that this is pre-act offenders can no longer be prosecuted federally, what would preclude the marshals from finding these people and continuing their search? And once they find them, saying, Nevada, here we found him. And what would stop them from being prosecuted under state statute in Nevada? What would preclude the marshals from continuing their apprehension? The only thing that would preclude that would be if the conservatives would come in, like they're going to do on the EPA, and they're going to come in and say, we need to dramatically reduce these agencies because a lot of their work is not valid. It hasn't been approved by Congress. And they're going to say, therefore, they don't need the large staff. I'll be curious to see if they come in and try to defund the marshals component that goes out. There's a particular component of the marshal services that tracks down sex offenders. And I wonder if they will be ready to publicly propose defunding the marshals and defunding the sex offender management, apprehension, registration, and tracking, the SMART office. I'll be very surprised if they want to do that defunding. That'll be one area of government where they'll be all in favor of keeping or increasing present funding.
So not such a great thing necessarily for us in the end. The one other thing that I never heard is that, I mean, you were saying that the state statutes might require you to register there. The states generally have some sort of clause that says, if you've ever been convicted of a sexual offense in another state, you have to register. That's the reason that you have to go register in the destination state.
Some states have more coverage than others. Some say it has to be an equivalent offense. The mere fact that you have a registration obligation in another state doesn't necessarily trigger an obligation. It has to be an equivalent or somewhat they use equivalent or substantially similar to one that was trigger registration. But I think this particular person's offense would have triggered a registration obligation had New York known about him. Now, he's probably well beyond the statute of limitations for New York. So if he gets his conviction overturned, if he's not beyond the statute of limitations, what would be funny would be if the New York state authorities picked up the prosecution and said, well, you've got your federal conviction overturned, but now it's our turn.
Right. Well, two articles to go. This one is from the Marshall Project. It's not something to cover for very long because it's a pretty well-known issue. The tent cities in Miami-Dade. 2,500-foot restrictions. It's a big article. It just came out in the last week or so. The title of the article is called No Mercy. I'm sorry, it's called Banished. The subtitle is called No Mercy. They're profiling people that have just these horrendous, horrendous living conditions. They're living in tents. There's no running water. That means no plumbing. That means no bathroom. Fine. You hate the people because they committed some really heinous crime. I'm not really sure how you expect them to live. Can you imagine if a hurricane rolls through? What are they supposed to do?
Well, this will give me a chance to circle back on what I was talking about, textualism. Banishment is a credible constitutional argument. But if you have a person who says that they look at colonial times as their guide, banishment, as it was understood in colonial times, was you were told to get out of town, not come back. And you're not told to get out of Miami-Dade County, not come back. So, if you're looking at the literal meaning of what banishment would have meant in colonial times, if you do not believe society has evolved in the last 240 years, and if you don't believe that the needs of society have changed in terms of an agrarian society where there were very few population centers back in the colonial times, if you believe that everything has stayed stagnant, then banishment literally did not mean telling a poor person they could not live someplace. I mean, the sex offender can be in town. They can shop. They can do a lot of things. They just can't reside there. That is not what the founding fathers thought of when they heard the word, the term banishment. So if you are a literalist and you believe that that all this evolving standards of decency is nothing but liberal mumbo jumbo, then that's how then that's how you get a decision from the courts, because the courts that cite to these arguments when they're asserted around the country, they look at the McGuire case, the district judge in Alabama. He went to the literal, well, he was a literalist, and he said, if we look at the literal meaning of banishment as colonial, as it was understood in colonial times, the fact that they can't live within 2,000 feet of something is not a banishment.
Right.
Banishment was when they ran them out of town. So, yeah. So folks who you want literalist and you want textualist, just be careful what you ask for. So, okay, in terms of the 2,500 feet, it's really a miserable life for people because there's so much of the, I mean, you run into as much as 90, 95, 96. I think in the case of Lewisville, Texas, I think Richard Gladden, who was attorney, said it was like 97% of the parcels of land in Lewisville were off limits. And the Fifth Circuit, United States Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans said it's still not a banishment because they can be in town. They just can't live there.
Yeah. Well,
and then the final article comes from NPR. Trump pushes due process for some, lock them up for others. If we go back through, there was a case they published or they talked about from a pretty long time ago. Like five people were accused of a pretty brutal rape and murder, possibly like in Central City Park. And he was all about lock them up, bring back the death penalty and all this stuff. They were acquitted through DNA evidence, which I find kind of an interesting concept here, is that, you know, if they had the death penalty, they would have nuked these people and they wouldn't be here anymore for then the DNA evidence to exonerate them. And now, based on all the Kavanaugh stuff, he's all about some due process. Just, you know, I mean, people can have their own ideas evolve over time, but, you know, anyway.
That's why I put this in here. I'm hoping that I've been disappointed in some of the stuff this president has said and policies he's pushed for. I mean, he effectively was the one who derailed federal justice reform in 2016 when he pronounced himself to be the law and order candidate. We were on the cusp of a major bipartisan agreement to dramatically change how long people were in federal prison custody. And that was derailed by Trump's law and order proclamations. He scared the daylights out of the conservatives, and they walked away from that. And he did the same thing again in 2018. They're worried about the coming up on the midterms. If the conservatives are worried about appearing soft on crime, so it's been put on the back burner again. But I'm hoping that I mean, I've also heard the comment about people who are in the country don't deserve due process. They need to be immediately deported. That's kind of troubling coming from the president. But I'm hoping that this experience with him being accused, and I don't know if any of the allegations were valid or not. I mean, I know he said with his own lips that he did the things on the Access Hollywood tape. But hopefully these people that have had these accusations against them, it will moderate their views from life experience. That's generally what happens to us. Our life experience helps us evolve. And I'm hoping that now Justice Gorsuch and Judge Kavanaugh and these people and President Trump, I hope that they, unlike Rush Limbaugh, who having been the victim of overzealous prosecution, according to his definition, I'm hoping that it moderates them and they realize that we need to go back and look at our system and make sure that we're meeting our constitutional requirements in terms of due process and that we're providing adequate protections for people who are accused. That's all you can hope for. And that's right. That's what I'm hoping that somebody will say, Mr. President, now, wait a minute, we agree with you on this due process, but wait a minute, didn't you just say last week that you didn't think people had any rights? I mean, how do we square that? Somebody needs to ask him that. And so I'm hoping that people will do that and they remind him that have access to him. He doesn't take my call.
I want to, so in closing, are we done? Is there anything else?
I think we're done. We've been blabbering for an hour and a half.
We have been. I want to address something. A comment literally just came in on the website talking about Narsal getting political. I think this person is referring to us getting political. And while you and I are both affiliated with Narsal through doing our own work for them, this podcast is not Narsal. This is something that my brainchild, so to speak. I invited Larry. It's a co-production between the two of us. This is us talking. This isn't Narsal talking about anything.
This is absolutely true. Maybe we should put that disclaimer in for something that we can record and say that the views expressed on this podcast are not those of any organization. They're the views of the cast.
Yep.
We're not representing the organizations when we're speaking here. And when I am representing the organization, I'll say that Narsal may be interested in this or that, but these are the views of the cast.
Yep. And when you decide to say 57 states, we know that it really actually means only 50. But so I just wanted to put that in there too. So I guess we should go through on how people can find us. How can they find us, Larry? I'll put you on the spot.
Very carefully.
Well, do you know what the website is?
Let's do a pop quiz. I know nothing.
All right. Well, the website is registrymatters.co. If you want to call and leave a voicemail, we did get like a very long set of emails from, I don't even know that the person left their name, but it was about 7 voicemail messages. They were very entertaining. It was really hard to make sense out of them. Love to have voicemail messages. Try again. It would be great. And that phone number is 747-227-4477. What else do we have? We have an email address at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter at registrymatters on Twitter. And then, of course, the best way to support the podcast is Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters.
Well, it seemed like on mine, there was a fade out of one of those digits, and I love that 7 number again. So what was that phone number again?
747-227-4477.
All right. Now I've got it.
Excellent. So feel free, call in, leave voicemail, all that, send emails, and of course, support the podcast, and we would love you forever.
I did listen to those messages, and I was struggling somewhat to follow all the...
They were funny. They were entertaining. They were definitely entertaining.
He was doing several takes, and when we got to the 5th and 6th one, I was... But if he can succinctly make the point, I'd love to hear it.
Yes, that would be good times. So thank you very much, Larry. As always, I appreciate it, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy.